We'll do that. Okay, so we are recording. This is Ryan Morini with the McCall Library at the University of South Alabama. Today is November 14th, 2022. And I have the pleasure of interviewing. If you just want to give your name.
Oh, Frank Leon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so thanks for joining me today. Can we begin with just when and where you were born?
Well, I was born in Columbia, South Carolina at Fort Jackson. My dad was stationed there, and my mom came up to visit, and I guess I couldn't wait. So, but basically, very shortly, within days after, returned to Mobile and was raised in Mobile.
Okay. And where in Mobile?
It would be considered, well, at the time, it was almost the western border of Mobile. This would have been at Spring Hill Avenue near a municipal park, which is what it used to be called, Langan Park. And we were on Dalewood Drive, right on the corner that fronted Spring Hill Avenue. So
Okay.
West Mobile, or what might be Mid Mobile by, in today's geography.
It seems like it has also grown pretty
Yeah.
quickly.
Western, yes.
Yeah. But so I guess all of your memories are of Mobile in terms of growing up.
Oh yeah, I grew up in Mobile, and in fact didn't leave until I went to college.
Okay. And so I believe your grandfather had a grocery store. Is that right?
Well, it was a dry goods store,
A dry goods
actually,
store,
and
yes.
it was a combination dry goods and hardware at the time. It was called Leon's Dry Goods and Hardware. The original location was on, I think it was Texas and Dearborn, and the secondary location was on Baltimore and Marine Street, in downtown Mobile.
Okay. And
So he had a combination of things that he sold there, clothing as well as hardware. He wore a coat and tie to work every day. In fact, I put on a coat this morning just as a tribute to him. And but he would always handle the clothing material, and he had my grandmother handling what he called the nails and such, so he wouldn't get his hands dirty and could offer you a nice shirt without his fingerprints on it. So.
can I ask his name or both
Yeah,
of your grandparents' names?
Tofey, Tofey Leon.
Okay.
And his wife's name was Wilda. Her maiden name was Mingus. I'm not sure if it was her cousin or how the relation worked, but Mr. Mingus was the chief of police in Mobile. Their family was in Slidell, Louisiana. I remember taking the train from Mobile to Slidell with my grandmother to visit her family and relatives in Slidell years and years and years ago.
Okay. So did they meet in Mobile or?
They must have.
Okay.
They that I would expect they would have. Of course, I have no direct knowledge of that, but based on a few pictures I've seen and such, they met in Mobile. My grandfather and his two sisters, brother. I'm trying to think of how large the family might have been back there, but they were all in Mobile. And I've seen pictures of my grandfather and grandmother before they were married. So, he was a very dapper young man at the time, and so was she for that matter.
And where was your grandfather from?
Beirut is what I'm told. So
Okay.
he immigrated from Beirut, Lebanon, and came to the States.
Okay. Did he ever talk about why he came to the US or?
No, in fact, of course, by the time I came along, and I guess was even able to form questions, that was really just never a question that came up. I don't know. Unfortunately, my mom and dad are both deceased now. And one or both of them may have had the answer to that question, but I do not know.
And so Mobile, there's no answer to that question either in terms of why Mobile specifically.
No, although there is in Alabama, in Birmingham, and in Mobile, there is a fairly strong Lebanese presence. I know there's a Lebanese American club in Mobile. I think one in Birmingham as well. I don't know that it was a targeted area, where people knew to come, or whether it was just happenstance. I have no idea why they selected Mobile.
Okay. How would you describe your grandfather as a person? How do you remember him?
Well, being the oldest grandson, I was his declared favorite. I ended up going to the 64 World's Fair with him while my cousins and my brother and sisters stayed home. So if that gives you any idea. So I just always found him very kind, very generous, and extremely loving of his grandchildren. We went to his house every Sunday. My dad, mom, my brother and sisters, my uncle, his three kids. We met on Charleston Street in downtown Mobile every Sunday. So it was just part of the routine. And his sister would come over. We would have family, his family and such. But it was just a family thing for him. Family, I guess, is what comes to mind when I think of my grandfather.
Okay. Who did the cooking for those family gatherings? Was that?
My grandmother, one or both of my grandfather's sisters, primarily.
Okay.
He would go to Pullman's Bakery, which was at one point in time, there was a location in downtown Mobile. He was an usher at the cathedral downtown. He would stop by Holman's and always get brownies and something else, but always brownies, I remember. So the guys, I guess, at that time, basically whatever they could pick up at the store, they'd pick up. But the ladies traditionally back then did all the work. And just so everybody will know, I do all the cooking in my family these days. So.
That's yeah, my dad did all the cooking when I grew up. It's but so was your grandmother cooking a lot of Lebanese food, or was it kind of more Persian food, or what?
It basically kibbeh was one. Meshi is what they called it, but it was a cabbage roll were the two main things that we had practically every Sunday. I really can't think of anything else than those two that we had because it was always fried chicken. I mean, just vegetables. There was a fig tree in the backyard. I mean, it was like going to a boarding house, in a way. There was just a lot of food and it was all good. So,
Sounds well. And so, where did they live? They lived in the
on
same neighborhood. Okay.
Charleston Street in Mobile. In fact, I don't know what the meets and bounds of what we had discussed as far as being down the bay. I'm not exactly sure where Charleston Street would fit into that grid, but at the time it was just catty corner to St. Vincent's Catholic Church, which was located, and I think is still there, if I'm not mistaken, the church is still there. Charleston Street was basically, in the homes of my grandfather and in the surrounding area, was basically demolished during a period of urban renewal that took place in the 70s.
Okay. What was their house like back then? I mean, how do you remember the, you said there were fig trees. Was there a garden? Like, was there
Well,
something
no,
like
just a backyard, and
that? Okay.
there happened to be a fig tree in the back.
Okay.
Of course, one thing I think that we all experience as adults, when you go back to a place that you haven't been to since a child, it seems a whole lot smaller than it did, when you were a kid. And
Yeah.
I can just remember going through the front door, and there was a hallway similar to a what in New Orleans, what would be a shotgun sort of layout, with a hallway going down the middle to an open area at the back of the house, which would be, I guess, considered the family room, bedrooms on the left side of that hall, a living room and a dining room on the right, and then the kitchen and everything kind of in the back. So it was a white house. It was in the 500 block. The street where we lived in Daphne was 501, and 501 keeps coming in my mind, but it was in the 500 block of Charleston Street.
Okay.
But the house itself was just a white wooden house. Nothing that really stood out about it, particularly in that neighborhood. You know, everything was wooden and typically a white painted house with nothing extraordinary about it. It did have steps going up to it, so it was raised off the ground a bit. And I don't know if that was by necessity, design, or otherwise, you know, whether I never recognized any sort of problems with water accumulation down there or anything. But in New Orleans, of course, you know, all the levee was the result of Andrew Jackson paying all his troops after the Spanish-American War, and they dug up all this ground to build up the levee. And that became the basin that Basin Street's named after. I don't think Mobile had any such problem, but, you know, but it was off the ground.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, and so what about the store? Did you know both of the stores, both of the locations? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. When I was a kid, again, being the oldest, I remember the first location very well, walking in the store. My grandfather always wanted to have merchandise on every shelf. And some of that stuff, I think there were hat boxes on these shelves that were up high in the perimeter of the store. It was basically a square box, flat roof, red brick, with Leon's Hardware, or Leon's, what did it say? I think it may have just said Leon's in big letters, and beneath that it may have had dry goods written on it. I was really hoping to find a photograph of that building somewhere, and maybe one will turn up somewhere somehow.
Oh, I think we have a couple. I'll see what we can.
Sure. Yeah. And but the store itself, you walk in. In fact, I think the opening was on one of the corners of the store, you know, so they kind of cut off a corner to put the door. And inside there, he had a counter with the cash register, where if what he was selling you cost $1.15, you'd press the red one, which was the dollar, and the black 1.5, which was a 15. Pull the jackpot handle, the drawer would open, and there you go. So it was a great store. It was in the middle. I wouldn't really want to distinguish it as the business district down there, but right across the street from him was Parker's Drugstore. Okay. And oddly enough, I rarely went into Parker's. There was really, you know, when I was down there with him, I was basically just either hanging out at the store or helping him over holidays. He would put me in charge of skates during the Christmas season. And these were the skates where, you know, you better have some good soled shoes, because they would just clamp onto the sole of your shoes with a skate key, which I doubt very many people remember these days. But I do remember they sold for $2 a pair. And on Christmas Day, if there were any left over, my grandfather, again, we would go to church together and then come back, and he would open Christmas morning after that. And I remember, since I was in charge of skates, that whatever boxes we had left over, we would hand out to the people that would actually know to come to the store on Christmas morning. It wasn't like a big ad in the paper or an advertisement. It was just being part of that community down there. So, you know, and there was no bravado about it. It was just the way it was.
Okay. And did you see people have a lot of vivid memories of roller skating, that folks who grew up in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, do you remember the kids roller skating around after?
Actually, I don't remember, you know, that street in that area, I don't think was very conducive, you know, for kids going out and playing, because at that intersection, there was my grandfather's store. Across from that was Parker's Rug Store. On the other corner was another cinder block building, a white building that my grandfather had built for my father and my uncle to, ideally start the hardware business over there and separate it from the dry goods, but they never opened that business. Or if they did, it didn't last very long for the two of them together. And on the fourth corner, there was this, it was like a shack, but it was a bar. And, you know, and people who lived down in that area would go in and out of there. I never went in there either, but I do remember going into my dad and uncle's store because they had toys in there. Of course, every little kid wants to bring a toy home. And that was my treasure box there. So, but that was the corner. And again, just to explain that it wasn't really conducive for kids to play in the street there. So, you know.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So what did it mean to be in charge of roller skates? Because roller skates, it sounds like, were a big deal at Christmas. Was this?
Every Christmas, he would order a box. I don't know how many pairs were in there, but I would say maybe 25, possibly more. You know, I don't really remember that. But it was just, I guess, just to teach me, you know, here's what a businessman does. And, you know, I don't think that I can tell you this without any hesitation. He always wanted me to be something. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget him telling me, Frankie is what they called me back then. My dad's name is Francis. And said, Frankie, there's two things you can be. You can be a doctor or you can be a lawyer. But remember this, people always want an old lawyer and a new doctor. So a young doctor and an old lawyer. And that kind of resonated with me. And I think my first aspirations, I wanted to be an architect. When I can remember that very vividly, when I was in fourth grade, I wanted to teach school, going through grammar school. Once I got into high school, I'd played football and basketball from second grade all the way through my sophomore year in high school when everybody else started to grow and I didn't. Then I joined the debate team and from there, you know, went on and got my law degree at Loyola in New Orleans.
Okay.
Came back to Mobile. That's another story. But sticking with the downtown area and such, the reason I think he put me in charge was just to give me a sense of responsibility. And I think without having said so, making me feel like I was capable of doing certain things and encouraging me to live up to my potential, if looking back on it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and so what do you remember about customers who came into the store? I mean, I guess it's a lot of folks from the neighborhood.
Yeah. That neighborhood was primarily a Black neighborhood. As it turns out, the law I ended up practicing, and this was not by design, involved representing longshoremen. And the longshoremen and their families lived down in that area. And I can just remember that they would come in for their work clothes. Blue jeans were called dungarees back then. So I remember a lot of people, and I don't necessarily remember names as such, but in my professional career, a lot of the clients that I represented, their fathers had come into the store and they knew the store. So, you know, that area, you know, it was I won't call it a landmark, but it was a part of that community that everybody could come and go to. And among the other businesses there, you know, beyond that corner, you had Kennedy's, which was an automotive place. Back then, you know, you could actually work on your own car and such. But if your car wasn't working, you'd take it to Kennedy's. There was a Fletcher's barbecue down that way. So, Kennedy's was, Mr. Kennedy was a Black man. The Fletcher family was a white family, you know. And the thing about it then, this is all before the civil rights movement, you know, when I got started down there. But it was just a normal place to grow up and be in without any reference to shades or colors or, you know, what people did for a living or didn't do for a living, for that matter. it was just a normal way for a kid to grow up. And I wasn't raised down there, but I was down there quite a bit. And then, of course, when the civil rights movement started, I was getting a bit older, but integration, when it started in the school system, I believe I was in fourth, maybe fifth grade, something like that.
Okay.
So I was still a kid, it didn't mean anything to me. In fact, I was kind of quizzical about, why all these kids, why are they all light like I am, for the most part.
Yeah. Well, and so I guess I should have asked just for clarification, but so you mentioned remembering $2 skates.
Yeah.
Roughly what time period is this? This is like the 50s?
Let's see. I was born in 1954.
Okay.
And I would say from, 64, definitely. I know I was, 10 years old or so when I was doing this.
Okay.
And by the time I was a teenager, I wasn't. I was a kid between 8 and 10 years old. Okay. And he was, and he was teaching me, how to work for a living, basically.
Yeah. Well, and so it sounds like part of what he would carry in the store were the things that people needed for work, like kind of work clothes and like.
Sure. Or church clothes. He okay. didn't sell suits, but dress shirts and ties. Okay. I don't recall any suits being there, but clothing is what he handled. And my grandmother, like I said, she had the nails and the hardware and such, which actually I couldn't give you the inventory. I do remember the storage bins for the nails. I do remember that. It was kind of a little fold out thing, with the different, pin. I can remember this, one penny nails or, how they were graded in terms of size and diameter and cost. So I do remember that. And putting them in little brown bags, when somebody needed some nails. Jogging my memory.
what I try to do. So would you say there was kind of equal demand for all the things in the store, or what sold the most? What did people come in for the most, would you say?
From my perspective, it was the clothing.
Okay.
And and people, of course, everything was cash business back. And but from what I can remember, check out, at the cash register. Either he or my Aunt Rosalie would handle the cash register. And honestly, this wasn't like a thriving business, where you had a constant flow of customers. There was a lot of downtime. It wasn't a community where everybody, just went out shopping. This was more of a need-based purchasing opportunity for the community that was served down there. So there was a big cardboard box. My Aunt Rosalie sat on that one. My grandmother sat on another one. And I don't know what was in those boxes, but it supported them. So they didn't cave in. And normally my grandfather would be just kind of leaning on the checkout counter, from being behind the counter. I remember, I can visualize their positioning in that store, waiting for the action or waiting for a customer, whatever. So, and they would just, just be a family, either talking, arguing, guessing about what are we going to do next. It's typical family just hanging out in the store. So, that was it.
Okay. Thank you. That helps to kind of paint a picture. Do you know if they ever accepted credit or any kind of if you get paid on Friday or anything? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Extending. Yeah. Oh, sure. Look, one thing about it. And I wasn't really old enough to fully appreciate it. So I don't want to take a big stab at, to know what was on my grandfather's mind. But I do remember, people coming in there without money or without enough money. And that did not put an end to the transaction. I don't know what words may have been exchanged or how that happened. But I do recall, because I could be behind the cash register too. That wasn't unusual. And They put the goods on the table, or my grandfather would carry them there, because normally in that scenario, if you can think of, like a clothing store these days, somebody's there to help you, and they will walk with you and show you, you might want this or you might want that. If you're looking for a shirt to do something in, they're going to direct you, well, go to this aisle and help you. And then he would bring it back to the counter, and then the transaction would take place. But I do have, it's more of a feeling than a direct memory, that whatever money was exchanged was, let's just call it negotiable.
Okay. You know? Okay.
Yeah, I think that would probably be the most accurate way that I can remember it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so did your grandparents have a lot of friends in that the neighborhood, or in the neighborhood of where they were living, I guess?
I do not remember any neighborhood people ever coming to the house. Now, St. Vincent's had a lawn party. That was a big deal way back in the day. And when we would walk across the street to the annual lawn party, I'm guessing that these were all people from the neighborhood that would go there. And I can remember trying to throw the ping pong ball into the goldfish bowl, and coming out with a goldfish. And, little things like that, throwing a beanbag and trying to land it somewhere, just the usual type stuff that would happen at a lawn party back then. I'm sure there would be cakes and other, things that people, bake sale type items and such as that. But that was really the only communal thing that I can recall from being down there. Our family really took up enough space as it was, in that house, and having many more people there just really wouldn't make too much sense. So, but I do remember there were neighbors on both sides, and my grandparents were aware of it. Their house was fenced in the backyard, wooden fence like you would see anywhere today.
Okay.
I never heard them express any words of exclusion or don't go over there or anything like, it wasn't like that. But it just wasn't. And look, this is a two-way street. I don't know whether people avoided them or whether, I don't think they were avoiding anybody, but there wasn't, I don't remember any neighbors as such, other than for one.
Okay.
And I don't even know where they lived then.
Hey, well, no, thank you. That, I mean, it just helps to know kind of, because I'm sure running a business, you're also, that's a lot of your life if that's where you are most of the time anyway. Yeah, so that makes sense. What about Mardi Gras? Did they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Big time. My uncle was in the MOTs, which was a big deal. Okay. In fact, both of his daughters were queens of the MOTs. So that, whatever. My dad was a little quieter and not so much into the social aspects. But there was a place on Government Street where I think is where Mahoney's law office is now. It was called the Toddle House, T-O-D-D-L-E. They have these things called huddle houses now. It was one of these places where you would go, and they have the stools, and the kitchen, kind of like a Waffle House type of thing. And the waiter we had, Reynolds, I can still see his face. Guy, he'd always have a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and a little paper cap, and the white pants and shirt. I don't think he may have, I think his collar was buttoned, so he may have worn a tie. There was a cigarette machine on one end. I remember it cost a quarter for cigarettes, to pull the knob and get a pack of cigs. Not that I got them, but I remember that machine being there. But we used to watch Mardi Gras. We would meet my grandfather, and he would drive his Buick to and us to some side street. We would walk to the Toddle House. I would always get, what do we call these things? It was a sunny side up egg and a triangle of toast. And you dip the toast in the egg, eat those and whatever. But I would always get that. I had a name for those eggs, but by the time we would eat and then go out onto the to the curb and wait for the parade to come in. And we would watch the parades there. And in Mobile, in downtown Mobile, they would have various areas where they would put up rides, you know, for the families and the kids primarily. And we would go on there. So Mardi Gras was a big deal back then, I think for all of Mobile, but for our family especially. It was some, it was an activity for the kids that that our parents and grandparents would take us to. And we had our spot, which was on government, you know, on government in front of the Tottle House. You might find a picture of that too. Because Government Street has changed dramatically since I was a kid. I mean, everything from the courthouse and the government building to the hotel down there. The Admiral Sims was down there, I believe. But where the current courthouse is now, if I'm not mistaken, that was the downtown theater where my grandfather would take us on Sunday. You know, I remember seeing the shaggy dog, Fred McMurray, turning into a big old dog, you know, and Darby O'Gill and the Little People, which still frightens me to this day. So, you know, but that's what we would do. Sundays meant going to the local areas, whether we would go to watch a movie at the downtown theater. We would go to Wanaker's, which was on Government and Catherine Street, which was basically a larger drugstore where I would either get a Superman comic book or something there. You know, we'd buy, you know, all the grandkids would get something there. Or we would go over towards the square downtown, the Enville Square, go to the A&M peanut store, which has always been there, it seems, get peanuts, and you'd crack the peanuts, put a peanut on your shoe, and let the bird or squirrel come and eat it off the toe of your shoe. So I tried that with my kids. I took them down there. I think they were able to walk more, and more importantly, run, because what happened is I put those peanuts on their shoes. It was like a Hitchcock movie after that. All these pigeons came down and just dive bombed them. Adele ran one way, Matt ran the other, screaming, you know, I guess as you grew, even the pigeons get a little harder on folks, I guess, as you get older, you know, I don't know. So, but yeah, downtown Mobile was a place. I can remember my birthday. My grandmother took me to Gafers and Cress's, which were two of the main stores in downtown Mobile. This was on Dolphin Street. And at the time in 64, when the Beatlemania started, I can remember going in, it was Gafers with my grandmother. I said, you know, what, I called her Sippy, S-I-P-P-Y. The Lebanese name, as I understand from grandmother, is Siti, something, I mean, I can only spell it phonetically, S-I-T-H-E-E, Siti, something like that. And Sippy is what came out of my mouth and became her grandmama name for all the kids. So I was asking Sippy on my birthday, because she was taking me shopping, you know, well, what can I get? He said, Frankie, the sky's the limit. And I remember buying a Beatle wig back then, you know, to wear out of there. Before the Beatles, I always wanted a Zorro masked sword and cape. That was my go-to, you know, whenever. So, but yeah, buying a Beatle wig at Gafers and then Cress's. And of course, back then, not that I was aware of it so much, but it was all segregated. You know, you had the counters, you know, for white and colored, you know, as the signs would say. You know, it's really hard to imagine all that, but that's it. The Sanger Theater, which is downtown, the balcony, as you walked into the Sanger, there was a stairwell with a sign that said colored with the arrow pointing up the stairs. You know, it makes me real sad, you know, to even think that that's the way it was, particularly with the way we grew up and the community that we grew up in. You know, how can we, you know, how can our friends and neighbors, I mean, why are they having to sit there, you know? So, but at any rate, I won't get all tied up.
Well, I mean, did your parents or your grandparents ever talk about that? Like, how did they explain segregation, or was it just...
No, it was never explained, because we lived in an integrated arena. You know, it wasn't like we were separated. The only thing I do remember when it came, my first confrontation, I shouldn't call it confrontation, but my first real awareness of segregation, because those signs really didn't mean anything to me. I just knew they were there. I didn't know what that really meant so much. You know, whether it was reserved seating or separation, didn't mean anything to me. I was still a kid. But at Municipal Park, one of those water areas was an actual place where we would go swimming. The house that I grew up in, we moved into in 1955. I was only a year old. But as I grew up, we would go to Municipal Park to swim. And in the 60s, they ended up closing it because as part of the advancement of the civil rights movement, those public spaces in a public park were to be integrated. So in response to that, I don't know who the authorities were with the control over the park system there, but however high up or how low it went, they closed down swimming there. And that meant for us who wanted to swim, there was a place, I think it was an 8 mile, if you look on your map, that's basically the Moffett Road area, you know, somewhere in North Mobile. There was a place called Johnson's Lake, which was a great place to go swimming. You know, they had, you know, where you could change, you know, a little concrete room or whatever. But they made it a club, you know, Moose Lodge versus whoever, I remember in law school. You know, the way you get around integration was to start a club. And basically, you had to pay something for a card to swim at Johnson Lake. Again, I'm a kid. I don't know. But that was where all the white kids could go swimming without having to worry about some black kid getting in the water and washing the black off and it getting on you or something. I don't know what people were thinking about, you know. But it's that's not as crazy as it sounds, I think, you know, for some people.
Yeah.
So whatever.
Yeah, well, but it's important to record these histories because a lot
I mean, that's a whole different story, you know, the civil rights movement in Mobile. You know, I mean, I could go off on a tangent on that, but just to keep on point. You know, there were a lot of changes that were happening in the United States as I was growing up, because as I grew older, of course, the Vietnam War was going on. And, you know, everybody was getting drafted. And my schoolmates who had older brothers, some of them weren't coming back. It was kind of scary to be, you know, 14, 15, and 16 in high school, knowing that you had to go to the post office and get your draft card when they're taking the top 100, and I'm 93. And I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, I'm scared to death. Like, I think anybody would be. I mean, I would have answered, but fortunately for me, they knocked it down to the top 50 because de-escalation was more or less happening by the time I was 18 under the Nixon administration. So I never had to serve. Not that I'm proud of that necessarily, but I'm relieved, you know, that I didn't have to face those decisions and those consequences.
But I mean,
again, that's another thing.
No, that was a difficult time to serve for sure, though. I mean,
those guys, I mean, I knew a lot of these guys with older brothers and friends of mine, you know, and they were different coming back. I mean, it was wild. You know, you can read about it. I was telling my son this, you know, I was telling, I forget what was on, but something to do with the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him, I said, man, that was just such a time. He says, Dad, I know about all that. I said, Matt, you know, there's a difference between reading about it and living it, you know, and of course, you know, as a person familiar with history, that was one of my majors in undergrad school, historiography, you know, you can have two people looking at the same battle, one from a mountaintop and the other one from the field, and you get two different accounts. They can be as extreme as who won the battle. So, yeah. You know, I guess as I get older, There are fewer and fewer people that remember those times, and to some degree, how we continue to relive, you know, a lot of the, well, currently, but, you know, divisiveness seems to be a, you know, a punch word right now. So there was a lot of division back then too. And the kids basically took over, you know, through sit-ins, through whatever. McGovern was running, you know, you talk about liberals now. Liberals back then basically listened to the 20-year-olds. And quite frankly, as a guy who's 68 right now, I'm ready for the kids. I wish the kids could start taking over and building the world they want to live in for them and their kids. It's not my world anymore. You know, let them do it. They're capable, certainly. I just wish they could get a chance. But heck, now, you know, you can be 70 years old and still working and not even leaving a spot open for a kid now, you know, to go to work. You know, all the old people are just hanging on, I guess. I don't know. I gave up my spot.
No, it's that kind of brings up, I have some questions about urban renewal, but before we get there, just so the two different stores, or your grandparents moved from the one to the other. What was the reason, and what was the difference in the spaces?
I don't know the reason. In fact, that store I have very dim memories of, because they did that. It had to have been in the late 60s. Okay. But by the time I was in high school and, you know, and such, or going, you know, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, and no longer, you know, the young kid going down selling skates, I was more interested in my own life by then on weekends.
That's fair.
But one thing that, this is what really sticks with me, that period of time, as we get into the late 60s, and the mid to late 60s, there was a lot of unrest. There was a lot of angry people that had suddenly become part of the fabric down there. And the reason my grandfather ended up closing his store for the first time ever, some people, whether one or a couple, I don't really know, came in, pistol whipped him, and stole all the money out of the cash register. And I saw my grandfather that Sunday. His face was black and blue. He was obviously disheartened. I didn't know what to think. But they were both getting older. My grandmother, grandfather, aunt, you know, everybody was getting older. And they had never, to my knowledge, ever experienced anything, you know, where they felt like they were threatened down there. And suddenly they were. And that kind of changed things a lot, you know, as to, you know, being careful. You know, they locked the door of the store every night. It wasn't anything like that. But that door was always wide open. I mean, there wasn't air conditioning as such. In fact, I don't know if they had an air conditioner in that first store or not, to be honest with you, because the front door was always wide open, you know, for people to come and go as they pleased. Whether they just wanted to come in and get change for a five, or, you know, come in and get something. So, but yeah, that's what closed it all down.
Okay. Well, that, so you mentioned urban renewal in relation to the house that they lived in.
Yeah.
What was that process like, or what do you remember about urban renewal?
Don't really remember anything specific about it. I never was, let me put it this way. When I, once I got in high school, I mean, we were still going, well, by that time, I think urban renewal had taken place, because on my mother's side, her dad and mom had passed away as we're getting into the 70s. And my grandfather, who had the Leon's Dry Goods and Hardware, they moved into that house, which was on Spring Hill and Catherine Street.
Okay.
So they moved because, I'm surmising here, but I mean, it's the only thing that makes sense, because their house was going to be taken and torn down. Now, I never went down there and saw, until way, way later. You know, I had no real reason to go back down there for any reason at all. But I do recall you had Washington Square there with the big metal deer in there with a hole in its side. You got to go down and check that out. But as a kid, we'd ride the deer every Sunday too. You know, that was another thing. But I was down for some reason. I had to go to the courthouse or something. I was just kind of taking the long way to go around and find a parking place and went down there. And you know, you could see Charleston Street, but I didn't even recognize it. And it was difficult for me to even place where the house used to be. So I really don't know anything about decisions or the whys and wherewithals of that, other than I heard or was told somehow through family that it was an urban renewal type of project that that was the reason why all those older houses had to go and newer housing was going. So,
okay. So your grandparents didn't express any feeling of being upset about moving or anything?
No. And okay. It goes back to this one thing. As long as their grandchildren and their sons and daughters were coming over and hanging out, it didn't matter what four walls you happened to be enclosed in. Yeah. You know, it really didn't matter at all. Because, I mean, by that time, I mean, we even had my grandfather's brother's daughters, Nancy and Shirley. They'd be coming over too. You know, I mean, the crowd got kind of bigger, you know, in a way. So, and it's not that they didn't come over before. In fact, my his sister, Aunt Catherine, her husband, George, from what I gather, she would come in. Now, look, keep in mind, this is like from a noon to six thing. You know, once Ed Sullivan came on, you know, we might watch that and then go home after that. You know, it was a lunch and dinner thing on Sunday. But Uncle George would sit in the car in the front of the house that whole time. And from what I gather, at least what my mom used to tell me, and my dad too, said one day George decided he couldn't walk anymore and just stopped walking, you know, and just sat in the car and wouldn't go up the stairs. I can barely remember even what he looked like, to be honest with you. But they had a store similar to my grandfather in Pritchard on Stone Street. And I'm trying to think what that store may have been called. I do remember going down there maybe once or twice. And it was a nice store too, but they served the community there, you know, so whatever.
That was also a dry goods store, like a...
Yeah. They sold clothing there. I can remember that, but I think I only went to that store once or twice. Latoff was the name there, so it wouldn't have been Leon's because Aunt Catherine married George Latoff. My cousin, or my dad's cousin, Mitch Latoff, great guy, great lawyer, gave me my start. He was, you know, basically the head of the Mobile Bar Association. I mean, just a great guy, smart as a whip. He and his brother, I mean, they were incredibly smart. I was just so privileged to I guess get my feet wet with him looking over my shoulder a bit. So everybody kind of made something of themselves, I guess. And I give credit for that entire family of elders, for lack of a better expression, for instilling basically a lack of fear. You know, we were never afraid. And just to tell you one other story. My grandfather is part of this dry goods business, sold Fruit of the Loom underwear.
Okay.
He took me to the New York World's Fair in 1964. We took the L&N line out of Mobile on the Hummingbird, 2 days and one night in a Pullman, sleeping. You know, I was sleeping on the top bunk. He had the bottom white tablecloths, you know, in the diner. It was great. Go to Grand Central, get out of there. We're there for I don't know how many days, but among the things we did is we went to this building, which wasn't like a skyscraper, but it may have been 10 stories. You know, it was a multi-floor building where Fruit of the Loom was. My grandfather, like I told you before, wore a coat and tie every day. I had a red blazer and a tie that I wore every day while we were there in New York. said, Frankie, come on, we're going to go meet Mr. Lazar. I said, okay. So we go into this building, go up to the top floor, meet this guy. I have very vague visions of what he looked like, but an older guy. And my grandfather went in there with me in tow, shook Mr. Lazar's hand, who was the president of Fruit of the Loom, as it turns out. Said, Mr. Lazar, I sell your product down in Mobile. This is my grandson, Frankie. Just wanted to say hi while I was in town. And one thing about my grandfather, he never graded people. Nobody was below him. Nobody was above him. And that's something he instilled in me. There's a quality that we all have that contributes to making the world go round. You have something that I don't have. I might have a little something that makes you and me together stronger than we would be apart. I don't know why that light comes on when I flip the switch. Thankfully, somebody does. Somebody might need me for something that I know how to do. And that was kind of the way he saw things. It wasn't like he was a braggart or felt that he was important in any kind of way, but he never felt as though anybody was more important than he was or any less than he was. And that quality, I think, is what really formed me when it came to the way and the nature of the work that I ended up doing for him. So, you know, but that's just another story, like I said. It, you know, I'm New York and meeting the dude who who ran the company just like it was some other guy, you know, from down the street.
But no, that's a great story. Well, so I have I guess the last question, kind of urban renewal related, is just what do you remember the condition of their house kind of being, or the houses in the neighborhood? I mean, did you see any issues structurally with them or anything?
Yes.
Like that? Okay.
That house, the house that my grandmother and grandfather lived in, and I spent the night there many times. The bathroom, you know, I mean, I don't know when these houses were built, okay? Mm-hmm. But I don't think they didn't build. I don't think they had that house built. I don't know for a fact. But I do remember that the back porch area, you know, was sagging on one side. You know, the house itself, if you were to go into that house today, you know, even in its best condition, you would feel a little uneasy, I would think, that, you know, this, I wouldn't want to live here kind of thing.
Okay.
The house was not pristine in any shape or form. It was worn down in places, the plumbing. You know, there was one bathroom. You know, it wasn't like everybody had their own suite like some houses today. But, you know, there was a bathtub and a toilet and a sink with some linoleum. There was linoleum and wood floors. I do remember it was linoleum and some of it peeling. But again, it never occurred to me that, that needs to be fixed or, you know, need to do something about that. But yeah, I would have to say that the house itself, just to answer your question directly, would need some work. You know, it's the most, according to my memory, that's the best I can do with that.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you. That's helpful. Now, as far as the actual dry goods, do you know where your grandfather got the stuff? Like, was it somewhere on the docks or what?
No, you know, I really don't know. That's a great question, because I can never remember a delivery.
Okay.
Coming in. So I have no idea. I doubt it would have come in through the port, though. I just can't imagine that. I think wherever the manufacturers were, I'm trying to, you know, I don't even really remember the tags on those shirts. There were tags there.
Okay.
But I don't think it was Van Heusen or, I don't know. Like, again, I was basically just hitting double digits by the time, I've spent my last days, going down there to do anything responsibly. So I don't know where they came from. Came from somewhere, and apparently I know where the underwear came from. I don't know how it got there, but I do know where the Fruit of the Loom building is. So, or at least I know to look for it the next if I'm ever back in New York soon.
Oh,
So.
fair enough. And I guess the main question I have remaining is, did your grandfather ever talk about Lebanon just growing up there? Did he have, share any stories or memories about it, or?
I don't think he ever shared stories per se,
Okay.
but I do remember him expressing how beautiful it was. I'd never sensed that he had a longing or some sort of strong sentimental attachment or wanting to go back or missing anybody. I do remember there a picture, I think my sisters have it somewhere, of his mom and dad. And I don't know where that picture was taken, but from the looks of it, it makes me think it was in the States. So I don't, I wish I could answer. I don't even know whether, when they got over here or who was it that came, honestly. All I know is they were here when I got here. And that's where they were from. And that's what is claimed as part of our heritage. On my mother's side, it was all from London and England and, that side. On my mother's father's side, it's Norwegian. And again, my grandmother was from Ireland. Mingus, was Irish. So, I've got a lot of different stuff going on. But I never sensed any sentimentality or longing for the old country from my grandfather. He was all into, let's get out doing what he was doing there, which was mainly, taking care of his family and wanting them to do all right. So that was basically it for him.
I can
I'm
respect
glad I kind of picked that up from him,
that.
you know.
No, it seems like he did a good job of instilling his values, I guess, in the family.
It was all by example. I mean, there weren't a lot of lectures or anything, other than that one little story that I remember when I told you about a lawyer or a doctor and one, and Frankie, you need to make something of yourself. I think he did mention something about putting on a coat and tie as being important,
Okay.
as far as distinguishing yourself, as a success, maybe. I don't know. I don't think he, I shouldn't have said that because he, I don't think he, I don't think he defines success necessarily by being able to wear a coat and tie. So I don't
Okay.
want to be misunderstood on that. But I
Sure.
think that he had expectations and believed that I was capable of doing things that I might not have believed that I could do. So I think that under different circumstances, with me having a different toolbox to work with, that he would have encouraged me in a different direction. But I think his encouragement was more from observation rather than I want to form or shape this kid into a doctor or a lawyer. I think that that's what he saw in me. And I think he wanted, I think there was a certain amount of pride, involved in that decision too for him, wanting to have a kid. But as far as his own kids were concerned, my dad worked for Western Auto after, after the stores downtown didn't work out. My uncle worked for Underwood Builder Supply before opening with a good friend of his, Pella Windows. So, but both of them were successful, in those trades and in those, in that type of work. It's just that, again, my grandfather, being the oldest male son, I don't want to sound like a Godfather movie, but, I think that he was glad that his first grandson child was of the masculine type thing, like Luca Brasi would say. That's one of my favorite movies, sorry.
mean, it's a good one. Yeah. So I think that's most of the questions that I have. Was there anything else you would kind of want to add for the record or any?
Ryan, I can't think of anything other than it's a pleasure to remember and recall a lot of these stories that really meant so much to me as I look back on, you know, impact of things that happen when you grow up. You know, I think people seldom reflect on how they got right here, right now, which is another lesson that I've taught my kids. I said, you know, you can make all the plans you want in this world, but one day, and probably on more than one day, you're going to have these moments where you wonder, how did I get right here, right now? I would have never planned this, but I always told them that a certain path you can take in life, you should at least be able to recognize the ones that are leading nowhere.
Yeah.
And then try and find the ones that are leading somewhere and be open enough to recognize forks in the road and believe in yourself and take a chance if you have to. But don't think that a setback is the finish line. You know, just keep going. Like somebody said, you know, you hadn't lost till you quit. So keep going, move. So I think that's how I felt, you know, from, you know, I shouldn't say I felt like I was, that he had expectations from me or that I would be letting him down in any kind of way. Sure. He just instilled, you know, a wanting to, not need to because somebody else wants me to, kind of, you know, pull on your resources and see what you do. See how you make a difference. Doesn't have to be the same thing. Thank goodness it's not the same. If everybody's doing the same thing, we'd all be gone by now.
That is the truth.
Brian, this has been a pleasure, man. If there's anything else, let me know. So, but I can't think of anything there.
No, I think this has been great. So thank you. It's been
you're a welcome. As well. Let me know how I can check this out one day. Hope it's a big success for you.
Well, thank you.